Although honeybees are just one kind of bee, they tend to get the most attention. Actually, there are an estimated 20,000 different species of bees in the world. And although we don't have the time to discuss each one of those 20,000 varieties, we've decided to make bees the subject of today's edition of Please Explain. Joining me now are Brian Danforth, Professor of Entomology at Cornell University, and Marianne Fraser, Senior Extension Associate in the Department of Entomology at Penn State University. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Marianne, colony collapse disorder has gotten a lot of attention in the news since it first began to appear in 2007. Does it remain a problem?
Well, you know, colony collapse disorder is unusual in that it's one of many things that we see happening to honeybees. I would say maybe it's gotten worse, maybe not, but what has certainly continued to get worse is the decline of pollinators, including honeybees. We continue to see the decline of bees in general, pollinators in general, and honeybees more specifically. And colony collapse disorder is one of the things that's contributing to that. And I would say, you know, that's probably limping along here. It's something that we've had a little bit of difficulty kind of sorting out what is CCD and what isn't CCD. But it is real. It is happening. But I would say it's easier to kind of think of it in terms of pollinator decline in general and CCD being one of the things that's contributing to that.
Well, what happens? Do bees just disappear?
The adult population, what is so odd about this is that the colonies are very obviously healthy and strong up until a point, and then all of a sudden the adult population is gone from these colonies, and they leave behind this colony that has a lot of brood, which are the baby bees essentially, a lot of resources like pollen and honey, and that's very, very unusual for honeybees to do that. And they would only do that if, you know, they, and we not be able to find them. Like sometimes they do that and they swarm or they abscond and we find the bees, they're gathered together in another location. But they only leave like that independently, the adults, whenever there's something wrong. They're sick or they think they're old or they're confused somehow and they don't make their way back to their home location.
Do we find the dead bodies anywhere?
It's rare. You know, honeybees will forage over 2 miles, 2.5 miles, sometimes even up to 3 miles. And so, you know, they can go that far. And so, no, I mean, when you're, you know, looking at an orchard or a almond grove that is, you know, hundreds of acres to find those bodies, no, that hasn't happened. We have not found those dead bodies. That's part of our struggle.
Now, Brian, Marianne said that this has affected all kinds of pollinating bees. So, but only pollinating bees?
I would say that the colony collapse disorder story really is only one that applies to honeybees. The honeybee is not a native species to North America. It was brought in the 1600s for honey production.
From Europe, wasn't it Europe?
From Europe, yes. Its natural range is Europe down to southern Africa. And it was brought in by European colonists. It's a very important pollinator. It's a very easy bee to cultivate. It can be moved around. In fact, it isn't really a native species to North America.
And are you making the suggestion that because it isn't native to North America, that may be a reason that after 400 years or so, we're seeing this problem?
No. The problem really is that honeybees have picked up lots of pathogens and parasites. Infected by mite pests, fungal pathogens, bacterial infections. They're infected with a lot of things that they picked up as a result of our sort of movement of honeybees around the world. So think of the honeybee as a cow. We cultivate cows in all parts of the world, and they've picked up diseases in all those different parts of the world. So what's affecting honeybees is unique to the honeybee.
And so the infections that we're talking about don't affect other kinds of bees?
As far as we know, most of the ones that are big problems in honeybees are either in closely related species of bees. There are Asian honeybees, for example, that have varroa mites. This is one of the big pathogens of the European honeybee. And those are pathogens and parasites that are limited to a very small group of closely related bees.
So, Marianne, is this problem now global? Are we seeing honeybee declines all over the world?
Yeah, I just want to just quickly comment on something that Brian just said. Brian, wouldn't you say that, yeah, CCD definitely, and these problems that are associated with honeybees like mites and diseases, which are true, and they are a problem not just in the United States but in many other parts of the world, but that the decline of bees, of pollinators, is – It is across species. In other words, we are seeing declines, not from CCD or these mites, but declines of pollinators in general. Wouldn't you say that's true?
Yeah, no, I agree with you. There's evidence.
Right.
There's a number of studies showing declines in native bee diversity in Europe, in North America. But I just wanted to point out that what's affecting honeybees, for the most part, is unique to honeybees.
That's true. Yeah, I agree with you 100%.
The factors that are impacting the native bees are mostly things like habitat loss, loss of floral diversity, loss of host plants, these kinds of things.
And it is true that this decline of honeybees and even of pollinators is not restricted to North America. It is, or to the United States even. It is a worldwide phenomenon. The problem is it's hard in many places. I mean, even in the United States, we don't do a very good job of documenting these things. So in other parts of the world, I mean, Europe, of course, they do a fairly good job, but in other parts of the world, like in Africa and South America and other countries, that, you know, there just isn't a lot of good documentation of what's going on. So it's been hard to understand how severe the losses have been in other parts of the world.
Haven't there been reports of honeybee die-offs before, over the past 100 years or so?
Marianne, do you want to answer that?
Is this the first time we're seeing something like this?
No, absolutely not.
I think Marianne is lost to us for the moment.
No, I'm here. I'm sorry. I'm here. I did have a little interruption there, but go ahead.
So I was asking whether there haven't been other cases of honeybee die-offs over the past 100 years or so.
Sure, absolutely. I think Brian was going to chime in on that, too. But, yes, we have seen, certainly from the introduction of this parasitic mite that he mentioned, the Varroa mite, we in the early 80s, for instance, in Pennsylvania, we had 80,000 colonies of honeybees. With the introduction of these parasitic mites, Varroa and tracheal mites, we have now only 30,000 colonies of bees. And most of that we attribute to these parasitic mites and the diseases that these things are transmitting. So that's one example. And there have been other examples, too, where we've seen declines of honeybee populations throughout their time here in North America.
Okay, well, let's put honeybees aside for a moment. First of all, Marianne Fraser is a senior extension associate at the Department of Entomology at Penn State University. Brian Danforth is professor of entomology at Cornell University. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. In a little while, we'll be taking your calls at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Brian, you mentioned earlier that there are other bee species that pollinate plants, not just honeybees. So if we have a decline in honeybees, does it really ultimately matter?
Well, this is what's so interesting about this. All the news coverage that CCD has generated is that it really has raised awareness of the existence of other kinds of pollinators. So as you said at the beginning of the program, there are 20,000 species of bees in the world. In North America, we estimate there are probably 4,000 species. And in New York State alone, we think probably 400 to 450 species. So these are diverse kinds of bees. They don't look in many cases at all like a honeybee, but they're very important pollinators in the natural environment. And I think we're learning more and more that they're important pollinators in the agricultural setting. So,
to a flower, do they look any different than a honeybee?
Yeah, they look quite different. So you can have bees that are tiny, bees that are the size of a fruit fly. You can have relatively hairless bees that carry pollen inside of their digestive tract, so they don't have the furry body that a typical a honeybee would have. There are larger, much larger bees like carpenter bees that nest in wood. There are even parasitic bees, so about 20% of the bees in the world are what are called kleptoparasites. They sneak into the nests of other bees and they lay their eggs. They're kind of like cuckoo birds of the bee world.
But how does pollination work? I understand why a honeybee would want to go to a flower to collect pollen to make honey, but What do other bees do to keep pollination going?
Well, all bees raise their offspring on a mixture of pollen and nectar. So honeybees are collecting nectar primarily for winter fuel, but they're also adding it to the pollen mix that they're giving to their offspring. The solitary bees, the vast majority of bees that are not honeybees, are collecting both pollen and nectar. In fact, they're more interested in pollen than they are in nectar. And they typically specialize on certain kinds of plants for their pollen provisions. They'll bring those pollen loads back to their nest, and they often nest in the ground or in a stem or in a burrow. They will carry those pollen loads back to their nest. They'll unload the pollen loads, and they'll make repeated trips. So they might make 5, 10, 15 trips. Once they've gathered all the pollen, they'll add a little bit of nectar to it, and then that'll be the food for an offspring. So they'll lay an egg on that pollen mass, and then the larva will develop on that. That's the life cycle of a typical solitary bee. Honeybees are eusocial. There's queens and workers.
Do we have any idea of how old bees are? Is there a fossil record?
There is quite an interesting fossil record of bees. I think the best estimate, the oldest fossil that is clearly a member of a modern bee group is a bee from the Upper Cretaceous, so that's 65 million years ago.
And where would that bee have been?
Sorry?
Where would that have been?
That was discovered in New Jersey, interestingly enough. And that is a stingless bee. It's a neotropical kind of bee that is a member of a modern group of social bees that actually do produce honey. They're distant relatives of the honeybee that we're familiar with. So that's the oldest representative we have of a modern bee group. If you look at the fossil record of flowers and the fossil record of wasps related to bees, the fossil record of bees probably goes back to at least 120 million years ago. So we think bees are about 120 million years old.
Marion, how long have humans been cultivating bees?
There are lots of paintings, cave paintings in South Africa and in Europe of honey hunters and so forth. So I'm not certain how old in terms of years, but certainly I would say the practice of beekeeping is quite ancient. We've seen a lot of and it's more maybe some honey hunting along with some very very minor keeping of bees. So swarms would enter clay jars, for instance, or skeps made out of reeds and straw, that kind of thing. And humans would maybe tend them very, very lightly. And, it's more of a sort of a harvesting of the honey and so forth rather than actual beekeeping. But I would say that practice is quite ancient. I don't know if Brian knows exactly has a better handle on the date there, but
I think it's 6,000 years ago, something like that. Okay. Those cave paintings in Spain, I think, go back 4,000 to 6,000 years ago.
Okay, great.
Now, we were talking earlier about birds communicating. Don't honeybees also have some kind of a language?
Absolutely. Honeybees have two different methods that we know of that they use in communication. One is pheromones, so they're chemical odors that they use to communicate, for instance, the presence of a queen, where the hive is located so that bees that are orienting can find the hive or if the hive's disturbed. So lots of different chemicals that are used in communication within a beehive. The other very, very interesting and intriguing method of communication with honeybees is dance language. And that's actually where bees, scout bees, go out. They find a rich nectar or pollen source and come back and can actually communicate that information, where it is, in terms of the location, the distance, the quality, and the quantity of nectar and pollen via a dance that they do on the face of the comb. And you can see this, and we can actually read this dance in a honeybee colony.
Brian, do other kinds of bees have this complicated social structure and all of these modes of communication, and do others make anything like honey?
Yeah, so the dance language is restricted to the honeybee and its close relatives. So the genus Apis is the group that does a dance language. There are other social groups of bees. There are social halictid bees, There are social bees called the allodapines. These are stem nesting bees. I think we estimate that there are probably five independent origins of fully social behavior in bees. Interestingly enough, the total percentage, the number of species of bees that are eusocial, is relatively small compared to the total diversity of bees. So my estimate is about 8% of bees are eusocial in the same way that honeybees are eusocial. The rest of them are solitary and parasitic.
And then they just meet each other and they mate?
Yeah, so when I say solitary, I mean the nest is constructed by a single female. She will mate early in the nesting season, and she will construct her own burrow. Sometimes they form these nest sites. They'll make nests in large aggregations. So there'll be many bees swarming around the ground, but in fact every single female is building her own nest, gathering her own food, and laying her own eggs.
We'll take a little break, and when we come back, take some listener questions. Our number here is 212-433-9692. My guests are Brian Danforth, professor of entomology at Cornell University, and Marianne Fraser, senior extension associate in the Department of Entomology at Penn State University. Stay with us. And we're back to today's Please Explain with Brian Danforth and Marianne Fraser, talking about bees and taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Let's go right to one of those calls. And we are very pleased to welcome to the air David from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello.
Yes, Brian. David.
Hi. Yes, my question was in relation to something Professor Danforth said earlier about declining diversity in pollination in plants that are pollinated. Could the prevalence of monoculture growth in the country or in the world, the way agriculture has tended to lessen the biodiversity of plants that are grown, be affecting pollinators?
And to add to that, another listener wanted to know about genetically modified plants.
Well, that's a great question. The large-scale agricultural production in certain kinds of crops, yes, would decrease pollinator diversity. I mean, I think almonds are probably the best example, where almond orchards are huge. They're heavily sprayed with pesticides, and there really isn't much bee diversity in those orchards. And that's a case where you really do need to bring in honeybees, and honeybees are essential for almond pollination. But there are other crops where the farms are smaller, where there's more natural vegetation around. We're doing studies in New York State of bee diversity in apple orchards, for example. And apple orchards range anywhere from 1 to 2 acres up to 100 acres in New York State. And we're finding an enormous diversity of native bees in these apple orchards. We have 40 to 45 species of native bees visiting apple flowers during the bloom period. And in fact, the native bees outnumber the honeybees in these orchards. So we think that the native bees are doing a fair share of the pollination in these apple orchards because apple orchards are a good habitat for native bees.
Thank you for calling us, David. We go now to Lewis from Queens. Hi, Lewis. You're on the air.
Hi. Great show. I just had a question and a comment. My question is concerning the difference between Africanized bees and European bees. Your guest stated that European bees stretch from Europe all the way to Southern Africa. And my impression of Africanized bees was that they were actually taking over the honeybee population, and they were more aggressive.
The so-called killer bees.
Yeah, killer bees, exactly. So question then is, if they come from a similar area, Africa, why are they so why are they so dangerous, and why are they wiping out the European bees? And my comment was that there was a Carolina parrot was apparently wiped out by the introduction of honeybees in the 1600s, and this was the only parrot that was native to Northern America. Apparently, the honeybees were taking the nesting areas of the Carolina parrot. And I'll take my comment
over
here.
Well, thank you for calling us. Marianne?
Yeah, I'll take a stab there at the African bee versus European bee question. It is the same bee. It's the same species. That bee that Brian mentioned, you know, our honey bee, Apis mellifera, is native to Europe and to Africa. So it's the same species, and it just so happens that they evolved over many, many, many thousands of years in two different environments. And so the bees in Europe early on were kept and managed and selected for gentle behavior, where the bees in Africa were oftentimes dealing with a lot of predation by birds and badgers and even by humans. Humans, for many, many years in Africa, hunted bees, essentially. And so those colonies that were able to defend their nest successfully were the ones that survived. And so over many thousands of years, these bees had very different behaviors in order to survive in that environment, including migrating to areas where there was plenty of forage, defending themselves against predators, reproducing a lot so that some of those offspring actually were successful at surviving.
What about stinging? Do all bees have the ability to sting?
Yeah, I mean, not all bees have the ability to sting. I mean, but honeybees, the different races of honeybees and even the different species of honeybees, yes, they can sting.
And that's their way of protecting themselves.
Absolutely. These honeybees build up these large stores of brood and honey and pollen, and so they're very desirable by predators like birds and badgers, and again, even humans who were after the sweetener, honey, and even eating the brood. And so they had to evolve a way to be able to protect themselves, and the way they did that was this very effective sting mechanism. The thing about African bees, what some people refer to as killer bees, is that they are very, very sensitive. When a bee stings you, it marks you with a pheromone, an odor that allows the other bees to know where the problem is, where to come and help join in the protection of the nest. And so the African bees are very, very sensitive to this alarm pheromone, and they respond very, very quickly. Our European bees, you know, again, we've selected them for gentle behavior. They're not nearly as sensitive to this alarm pheromone, so they're much slower to respond and don't keep up the pursuit of their whoever is bothering them for long distances, whether it's a human or an animal, whatever. So,
well, let me talk to Brian about that other question, not that it really is germane to our conversation, but we normally talk about bees as having a very positive effect. The caller suggested that they can also have a negative effect on the environment.
Yeah, well, I thought I'd just add to what Marianne said, that the African bee, the African variety of the honeybee that's often, that's called the killer bee, is now established throughout much of the southern United States, so Southern California, much of Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, all the way down into the panhandle of Florida. There are populations of the killer bee. I have to say that we're to blame for that. The killer bee was brought into the Western Hemisphere by a Brazilian biologist named Warwick Kerr in the 1960s, and he was trying to breed the African variety with the European variety to produce a bee that would do very well in the Brazilian environment. Some of the queens escaped, and since 1960s, the spread of these bees has progressed very rapidly, so that they've covered now much of South America, much of all through Central America, and now they're widespread through the southern part of the United States.
Should we take any comfort in the fact that they die after they sting?
That might be some comfort, but the problem is they leave their sting in your body, and the sting continues to pump venom into your skin. So,
oh, how nice.
And they have a lot of workers in their colony, so one worker doesn't really count for much.
We go to Tom from Long Island. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I wanted to know the problem with yellow jackets and honeybees. I had yellow jackets in the ground and honeybees about 30 feet up in the air for years in a hole in a tree, and it seems like the yellow jackets now have taken over. Are they, first of all, are they pollinators, and second of all, do they actually chase out honeybees?
And also, are wasps pollinators?
Oh, wasps, yes. I meant to add wasps to that.
Brian, or do you want me to go for this?
I can say something about yellow jackets. The yellow jackets are primarily predators. So they are good biological control agents in your garden. I don't think that they would necessarily go after a honeybee colony. They might have occupied the same cavity, but I don't know any reason to think that they would be displacing the honeybee colony.
And I would have to agree with that. I mean, we have never seen, in my experience, a case where wasps will displace honeybees. And they are very, very, very different. I mean, we think of honeybees and bees in general as sort of the vegetarians of this group called Hymenoptera, and wasps, hornets, and yellow jackets are the carnivores. They're feeding on other kinds of insects typically and getting their protein instead of from pollen like bees. They're getting their protein source from other kinds of insects. So, but typically those two groups don't compete with each other.
A listener wants Brian to answer this question. Can you talk about carpenter bees? Do they actually bore into wood?
Yes, they do. The females will chew into wood with their mandibles. They have very strong mandibles, and they can burrow into. Usually they go into relatively soft wood, sometimes the trim on a house, or you often see them around barns where there's a bit of rotting wood that they can burrow into. So yes, they do. They construct their own burrows, and then in that burrow they do what a typical solitary bee would do. They partition that burrow up into little cavities, and into each cavity they put a load of pollen and nectar. And they lay an egg on that pollen and nectar mass, and then that that egg hatches and turns into a larva.
Let's take another call from David from Long Island. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. My question was, what can the average person do to help bees? What can I plant? What can I put in my backyard? What can we do?
I have heard recently that there's been a renewed interest in having honeybees. I guess that's one thing that people have done once they've heard about the colony collapse disorder. But what else can people do, Marianne?
It is fascinating. We have had a real resurgence in beekeeping. There's been all the bee schools throughout the Northeast and are full to overflowing, and there's a lot of pressure on the equipment dealers and on the people who supply packaged bees from the South to fill the need here. And so there's been a lot of new beekeepers, a lot of people, you know, wanting to keep one or two hives of bees in their backyard. But absolutely, I mean, I'd say two of the most important things that people, homeowners, can do is, A, for all pollinators, not just for honeybees, but for all pollinators, is to be very careful and responsible about the pesticides that they use around their homes. We're actually working on the issue related to colony collapse disorder on pesticides, and we are very concerned about the levels of pesticides we're seeing in honeybee colonies. And homeowners use a lot of pesticide herbicides to get rid of weeds, which are things like clover and dandelions, which are the nectar and pollen sources for these bees. So first, they're removing food source for the bees, and secondly, they're using, you know, insecticides. Bees are insects, and we are fearful that some of these insecticides are actually toxic to the pollinators, honeybees, and again, solitary bees as well. So that use of limiting your use and being very careful about your use of pesticides around the home is hugely important. And secondly, there are a lot of pollinator plants that can be planted to provide nectar and pollen sources for a lot of plants that can be planted to supply these bees with food sources. Sometimes just letting a section of a yard just go into meadow is advantageous. It supplies nesting sites for some of these solitary bees, and also provides forage, food, nectar, and pollen for these bees as well.
Rich from Huntington,
Long
Island.
Can I just add one?
Sure, go ahead.
One quick thing to what Marianne said. I think your listener would also be interested in to know that there's a society called the Xerxes Society, which is interested in invertebrate conservation, so bee and insect conservation. There's a website, XerxesSociety.com, and they have some information on preserving and supporting native bees and other kinds of pollinators.
Now, Rich, hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I'm a beekeeper here on Long Island. Hi, Marianne. It's Rich Blom.
Hey, Rich. How are you?
Good. My question is just that over the last 2 years, I've noticed We're getting a lot more calls for swarms. The feral colonies are doing well. My bees are doing very, very well. And I'm wondering if we're noticing that in other parts of the country, or is it... My feeling is it's the commercial beekeepers that remove bees a lot that have problems with CCD.
From the surveys that have been done and from our own experience, we're, again, CCD possibly more so with the commercial beekeepers, but again, beekeepers having troubles with decline and keeping bees alive, I'd say that our experience is beekeepers in general are having a very difficult time keeping their colonies alive from year to year. We do think that beekeepers, some beekeepers as well as the wild populations are able to develop resistance more quickly. There's some beekeepers who are trying to not use chemicals to control their mites and try to let the bees on their own develop resistance. And also in the wild population, we are thinking that we're seeing some resistance to mites and diseases occurring in that wild population as well. So yeah, I think you're right that there is some hope here that that the bees on their own, and as a matter of fact, even more so than with our help, are going to recover from these things. But it's going to take some time.
We have very little time, and we want to get Sue's question. And Sue, can you make it very quick and an answer very quick? Well, Sue, I asked you to do it quick, and you didn't. So I'm going to finish up with one question. What about loss of habitat and diversity? Is that having an impact as well as places are developed?
I absolutely. For pollinators, both honeybees as well as for solitary bees, loss of habitat is a huge issue, yes.
And I want to thank the two of you for being with us today to talk about bees on today's Please Explain. I've been speaking with Brian Danforth, professor of entomology at Cornell University, and Marianne Fraser, a senior extension associate in the Department of Entomology at Penn State University. And we will be following the story about the bees and hope that the bees recover, because I think that the alternative is rather horrifying. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for your support.
Thank you.
On Monday's show, and just days after the shootings at the Holocaust Museum, Leonard Zeskind gives us a comprehensive history of the white supremacist movement over the past three decades. And then Francis Ford Coppola discusses his latest film, Tetro. We'll get a preview of BAM's Cinema Fest, plus Alistair Horn on how Henry Kissinger shaped the year 1973 from Vietnam to Watergate to the Arab oil embargo. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Drew Katchen, Sherry Shin, and Nicole Silbersack. Dimitri Krasny was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. We'll see you on Monday.